bring the lights down? Okay. Well, I think, are we in a condition now where everyone can see and hear what I'm doing? Okay, so I've been asked to cover the topic of the possibility of observing so-called the Transplanckian physics. This whole field sometimes goes by the name of the Transplanckian problem. Well, I know that since Robert's in the audience, he deserves credit both for, I think, really drawing attention to the field's attention to this as being something that we need to worry about, this area. And I know that Robert in particular is fond of calling this whole issue the Transplanckian opportunity, because Robert sees anything that's a problem for cosmology as being an opportunity to do something different and hopefully better. What I'm going to say today is going to focus primarily on the prospects of actually observing the effects that are associated with Planck or string scale corrections to the calculation of the CMB spectrum. As I'm going to explain as I go on, and there isn't a detailed theory of what these effects might be, but one can certainly take a guess as to at least their form on the basis of dimensional analysis and maybe some arguments from effective field theory. And so I'm going to more look and say, well, if the effect is there, is it something that even in principle we could measure? And in that sense, it's very, very nice to be following on from the talk that Dick gave, because I think it's clear that we've really only scratched the surface in terms of what we can pull out of the sky, pull out of observations of the sky. And so this is not necessarily something that would be happening in the next few years, but it's certainly something we could think about, that we need to be thinking about as we go ahead over the next 20 years. And my work in this area is primarily with Brian Green, Will Kinney, Gary Hsu, who's here today, and Haranya Pierce. And so what I say is obviously going to owe a large debt to my discussions with those people. And so in reality, one can think about this as three related questions, the way I like to think about this. And whenever I give this talk, I always give some variant of this slide. And the first question is simply to say, do we really understand the generation of cosmological perturbations? And I'll explain exactly what I mean by that in a minute. But the answer to that question, to give it away, is that yes, we do understand them, certainly to the 1% level. We don't expect that there's going to be any surprises there. And so having said that we understand them, the next question is, if we put some minimum length, in other words, some new scale of physics at which our conventional understanding of general relativity with minimally coupled quantum fields in the TMU new sector is, if we add those things, does that have an impact on the way that we understand cosmology? And the answer to that is maybe. I think that, and to some extent, certainly if you want to say that they're strictly speaking non-zero, I think that everybody who's worked on this agrees that there is some non-zero effect from adding this new scale. The argument is how different from zero that effect is and whether or not it's actually going to give a result that we can actually see. And then the last question is, can we see Planck scale physics in the CMB or large scale structure? And the answer to that is simply if we're very lucky. And this, in a sense, is the same. In fact, it's going to be directly related to the question, say, can we observe the tensor modes, fundamental tensor modes in the CMB? And it's certainly true that inflation is bound to generate those tensor modes, but we can only actually see them as the universe is kind and gives us an inflationary model that happens where inflation takes place at a relatively high energy scale. And so we're in exactly the same boat here, and we're going to find out that, in fact, the amplitude of the tensor modes is actually going to enter this problem in a somewhat unexpected way. So in other words, it's entirely possible that the minimum length could have, in principle at least, could mean that the predictions for the perturbation spectrum are different from what we might have otherwise expected. But that difference could be so small that no conceivable experiment would be able to pull it out of the other things that would be influencing the data. So the question is, in other words, what is not happening here? What I'm talking about is a minimal stringy modification to standard cosmology. And so in that sense, it's kind of nice because it means that we're adding an effect that we don't understand to a system that we do actually understand pretty well, which is to say, inflation driven by general relativity. So this, everything that I'm saying here, I think, is best interpreted as a feasibility study rather than a kind of detailed calculation. And the two motivations for that feasibility study are, one, that we have high quality data, again, as we heard from Dick this morning. But I mean, it's generically true that even in the lifetime of someone who's comparatively junior, that calculations in cosmology have gone from the sort of things that you do on the back of a fairly small envelope to the sort of thing that you then had to do on the back of an A4 envelope or a letter-sized envelope, and another sort of things often that you really need to tackle in a serious computational way. And so the other thing that's motivating us to push ahead on this is that the chance to actually test string or Planck scale physics in any meaningful way is obviously something that you know, is one of the holy grails for understanding what's going on in theoretical physics at the moment. And that on the one hand, because of the kind of the stakes involved, it seems worth to play whatever opportunities we have is something that we have to engage with. Simply because there aren't very many clear ways of testing physics at these scales in any other arena. What this is not, on the other hand, is cosmology directly based on string theory. So we're not talking about corrections to the Einstein action from higher order terms. We're not talking about brain worlds. We're not talking about a kind of brain gas or Brandenburger-Waffe scenario. We're not talking about holography. We're not talking about inflationary models necessarily that are built directly within the context of string theory. So everything in here, if you'll pardon the pun, is just a perturbation to well-understood physics. So there's a general kind of statement of principles, that's what I'm calling a statement of principles. And the first thing is that there's no consensus, as we're going to see, there's no consensus as to what the Trans-Planckian modifications to the CMB might be. That's the first kind of... Well, it's not really a principle. I'm realizing that it's the sort of principles that are governing this work, I guess, but it's a statement of the current situation. It's probably a better heading here. But we do know that they have to be small. I'm going to explain why that is in a second. And the third thing we know is that the CMB and LSS data, large-scale structured data, is getting better, but that it's still noisy. And so the conclusion is that we're looking for a tiny effect. We're looking for it's got an unknown form, and we're trying to find that effect inside of messy data. But on the other hand, I'm going to argue that the problem is interesting enough to keep going, but that this, as I said, really is only a feasibility study. So I just want to, in one slide, review everything that you know about confronting theoretical predictions from cosmology with experiment. And so in general, what we do if we actually want to figure out what's going on, at least naively, is that we can, given some model of physics, we can predict what that physics is going to provide for us in the microwave background. So we calculate the CMB spectrum, and this calculation is typically encoded in some computer code such as CMBFast or CAM. And there's a whole range of inputs that go into that, isn't there? The baryon fraction of the universe, the amount of dark matter that's present today, the Hubble constant, the cosmological constant, whether or not there's spatial curvature. But the one place in which fundamental physics really comes into this is in terms of when we specify the underlying spectrum. And so naively, you know, people will specify the spectrum as being some power spectrum that's proportional to k to the power of n minus 1, where n is the scalar spectral index. And n is pretty close to 1, and so we've got a scale invariant spectrum, or largely the first order of scale invariant spectrum. So usually that's just two parameters, the height of this power spectrum plus n, and maybe allowance for running, so dnd log k, plus a tensor contribution. And so the effects that we're talking about here are effects that that modify the underlying power spectrum. In other words, the thing that you input into CAM or CMBFast at the very beginning, and then feed that power spectrum through all of the astrophysics that actually determines what we see when we look at the sky. And so what I want to do now is to just give a brief dimensional analysis argument as to why it is that we should care about this issue. So we know that inflation has to occur at the gut scale or lower, in some sense, at least in terms of the scales involved. It makes sense possibly for inflation to be occurring near the gut scale. The argument that we've heard before that if we don't want the VEVs involved in inflation, if we're getting much larger than the Planck scale, means that it's possible that inflation actually works better somewhat below the gut scale. But we can assume that we have a reheating temperature in inflation of the order of maybe 10 to the 15 GeV. And so we know that the Planck temperature is 10 to the 19 GeV. We know that the Planck length is 1 over that temperature. And so what that corresponds to is if we plug in all of the units, it corresponds that if the universe today is about, large scale in the universe is about 10 to the 10 light years, that's about 10 to the 61 Planck lengths, and the universe today is about 2.7 kelvins. So we know that between now and the end of inflation, the universe has grown by a factor of the temperature at the end of inflation over the temperature today, which is to say a factor of 10 to the 28. So that means that the longest perturbations that we see in the sky today, in other words, things that are out of the sort of low else of the CMB spectrum, have typically grown by a factor of maybe e to the 60 during inflation plus another 10 to the 28 afterwards, which means there's been a total growth of around 10 to the 54. And so what that's telling us is that unless inflation is absolutely minimal, in other words, unless you only get the kind of 60 e-foldings that you need to produce a working model of the universe and no more, and inflation happens near the gut scale, it's telling us that inflation... Yeah. That the temperature... Hang on, T end. T end. Did I That should be T today. Sorry. Yep. I think, yeah. So Ada, the temperature today over the temperature at the end of inflation. So T end and T reheat, I'm actually accidentally using the same variable twice. So the T end over T reheat in some sense would be 1. So that is a typo. I apologize. But it's essentially measuring, I mean, what that fraction is measuring, it's just saying that the ratio of the temperature after reheating to the temperature today is essentially 1 over the change in scales. Yeah. No, I can hear you, yeah.
But you could have a considerably lower reheating temperature.
No, that's exactly true. It turns out that the actual scale of inflation is going to enter what I say next in a fairly fairly concrete way. I think in general, if you have a model of where reheating occurs by parametric resonance, the extraction of the energy from the inflaton field into particles is usually reasonably efficient. So I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that the universe reheats to something close to the inflationary energy scale. So that's all I'm really assuming is that reheating is prompt. That it doesn't, that it doesn't go by some very slow and inefficient channel.
Don't you get problems with defects and gravitinos if you have a
you get problems with that, and there are mechanisms for solving that problem. What I'm saying here is at a much broader brush level than actually. And I guess the other comment I'd make is that what we really care about is the energy scale of inflation. If you wanted to put the reheating scale lower, then that would change things a little bit, but it would just mean that you need a little bit, you needed inflation just to be slightly more non-minimal in order to have this problem show up. So the only physics that really matters is the inflationary energy scale, not really the reheat temperature. That's what you're talking about is in some sense a second order effect. But you're right, in order to build a working model, you've got to make sure that all of those issues are addressed. I'm not trying to say that, the points that you raise are valid, but at the level of the calculation I'm doing here, we can forget about them. What this means is that if we look at the physical length scale that corresponds to, say, a perturbation that now stretches from one side of the horizon to the other, it means that scale actually corresponded to a physical length that was probably less than the Planck length at some finite time in the history of the universe. And so if we think that we can only meaningfully describe, we can only meaningfully think about the space-time, general relativity and perturbation to that background at length scales larger than the Planck scale, it means that when we actually come to do the calculation of the perturbation spectrum, which implicitly involves taking a limit in the infinite past, it means that we're basically setting our initial conditions in a region where we think that our theory has no validity at all. And so it's the essence of this problem is to try and make some physical sense of what that means. And so it is possible, by manipulating the numbers as we saw here, that you can assure that at least the long scales in the universe were not sub-Planckian at any point during inflation. But on the other hand, the short scales were almost certain in the universe were almost must have been sub-Planckian at some point during inflation. So you can kind of fudge the problem for the long scales, but you can't fudge the problem for the short scales. So to continue this dimensional analysis argument, we're just going to put some random or some arbitrary fundamental scale into the theory. It could be the string scale, it could be the Planck scale. I'm not going to get directly involved with that. We know that the quantum gravity or Planck scale is 10 to the 19 GeV, but we also know that it's entirely reasonable that the string scale could be a couple of orders of magnitude below that. If we say that the inflationary energy scale is 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 15 GeV, we know that that's related to the Hubble scale, which is giving us the length scale of inflation. So we've got the only dimensionless combination we can form is the ratio of the Hubble scale during inflation to this new mass scale m. And so just on dimensional analysis alone, the impact of this fundamental scale is going to go like h over m to the p. And so the whole question in this problem, the hundreds of papers we've written trying to make sense of this problem, is really whether this number p is equal to 1 or equal to 2. And so if p is equal to 1, we're looking at something that's potentially a 1% effect and something that's potentially observable.
I was just going to ask, once you know that you're going to parameterize your physics by h over m to the p corrections to some effective action, suppose you did find some complicated signal on top of what you expect that was a small effect, how would you know that it doesn't just come from totally vanilla, higher energy?
Can I address that later? Actually, I'm going to get to that later in the talk. It's a beautiful question.
Now, maybe it's a related question, but I'm just trying to understand. So, are you interested in effects just coming from higher dimensional operators? So very conventional in the sense that we know how to do calculations, or something really related to something much less under control, which is Franz Planck.
At this point, anything I think I would want to include in that soup. What I'm going to explain very briefly later on is that a nice way to think about this is in terms of high-dimensional operators that have been turned on by some UV completion that we don't understand. And so the key thing is here is we have a separation of scales, and that's screaming out for us to use effective field theory. There's some wrinkles with that that I'm hopefully going to have time to get into, but we'll see where that gets. One other question? Robert?
But if you go beyond the effective field theory approach, the way that Paolo indicated, then you can get effects of order one that are not even suppressed by H over M Planck. And the only way to constrain those effects is actually by back reaction. If you then take into account back reaction, you can then get those effects, constrain them to be order M of H over M Planck. So I think when you say that effects are order H over M Planck or smaller, this is already a fairly conservative point of view.
I like to be conservative. At least, at least when I'm talking about things that that nobody understands, I think it pays to be conservative. So anyway, the problem is we can't do an ab initio calculation of the generation of perturbations in string theory. No one's been able to do that. So we have to introduce the minimum length bar in UFS. And typically, I'm not going to talk about the effective field theory approach yet, but typically there's two ways to change things. You can change the evolution of the perturbations once they're generated. And it typically leads to a P equals 2 effect, in other words, H over M squared, unless you have some kind of some breakdown of eta vorticity. Or you can change the initial conditions, which is typically leads to a P equals 1 effect. What I want to point out is that what we're actually observing in practice is we're observing the very, very late time limit of a solution to a linear equation. The perturbation equations are a linear second order differential equation. We have two solutions. So in principle, any change that we make to the evolution can always be rewritten just in terms of a modified initial state for the unchanged evolution equations. In other words, we can always do a vacuum rotation that will produce the same result.
Does the universe expand into a preordained background space? Or do you make space-time lumps, or Planckian space-time lumps, as quantum gravity people would tend to do?
This would be the standard understanding of general relativity, that space is in some sense created as the universe expands. And so part of the problem, I mean, if you want to think about this in terms of quantum gravity, you think that space comes in little discrete packets, but on the other hand, from the point of view of general relativity, space is something that's continuous. And so in some sense, what we're seeing here is a tension between those two understandings.
Do your words depend on a framework or independent?
No, my words,
they do not.
Everything that I'm saying is done as a small correction to physics that we believe that we understand well. In other words, we have a picture of the early universe that we understand pretty well, and as we've heard from Dick, agrees well with observations.
Like, well then, if you have, for example, a background, mm-hmm. a fixed background, and then when you go backwards in time, as you say, you go into the sub-Planckian scale. Uh-huh. And then these modes are not usual modes because the gravitational interactions dominate. So then what do you think of? Do you think that there's a reservoir of the higher things of strings which are black holes or what?
I'm not sure that I need to think about that at all. I'm simply trying to parameterize
these. That you rewrite a modified initial state for the modes.
Yeah, right.
How do you modify?
Okay, I'm getting there. Let me get on to the next slide. I think hopefully it will become more apparent.
Oh. Just related to what I was saying, you said that the possible effects are ratio between H and a typical high energy scale M to a certain power. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure to understand because for example, if you add the higher dimensional operator to a conventional Lagrangian, then you have another scale, which is, for example, phi dot, so the motion of infinite. And for example, what Shamit was saying, yes, so in models like DBI inflation, the physical effects are not related.
And models like which inflation?
Like DBI inflation, which is just a Lagrangian, which is more complicated than the usual one. And the effects are not just ratio between H and higher dimensional scale. also phi dot is another possible scale. So
yeah, no, that would be true. I think. I mean, this is. I mean, what I'm trying to do is simply to say, well, let's take the minimum modifications to the general relativistic framework, and even in the context of those modifications, there has to be a difficulty. And I think as you go to more complicated models, then I think the difficulties that you can get will become more barren. But this, I mean, we can't do a well-controlled calculation. It doesn't. You want to understand the simple systems before you understand the complex ones, I think. So the standard, I just want to remind us, like again, one slide, how we do the standard calculation of mode generation during inflation. So we know that the perturbations have to obey this equation here with this z prime prime. The z is actually some complicated function. And we know that at very early times, which is to say conformal time goes to minus infinity, we know that the modes have this form. And the reason we do that is that this guarantees that we have nice bosonic statistics. And it means that we're effectively fixing the amplitude of these guys that when their physical length scale is arbitrarily small. And so the problem is you might say, well, let's actually, and one hypothesis we could make, oops, hang on a minute, sorry. Agenda the two pages at once here. One hypothesis we could make is that, well, let's say that instead of fixing the length scale for the modes at an arbitrary time in the past, we actually fix each mode at the moment when that each mode is fixed at a different time, but at the time when its physical wavelength is larger than the Planck scale. And this is purely an ansatz. It's purely something that we've put in by hand. It looks kind of reasonable, but we're not saying that it's not something that we've calculated. It's simply something that we're getting. But it turns out that when you do that, the two parameters here that appear in front of the two different solutions to the mode equation, these two Hankel functions here, it turns out that in the case where you're doing things in the limit of the infinite past, this term C minus is necessarily zero. But it turns out that when you actually turn this correction on, you say that it has this fundamental form, but it acquires it at some finite time in the past. It turns out that this C minus parameter goes to H over M. And it turns out that if you actually work through the details for this ansatz at least, you can actually work out a fairly general result in slow roll inflation for the monophyte spectrum. And the details of this are in the paper that I wrote with Brian and Gary and Will. And so the actual form of the spectrum that you get is this has this complicated form here. And so what you see is this, the P on the right-hand side is just the standard spectrum, whatever that happens to be. So that has all the standard scale dependence you would expect from your particular model of inflation.
Inflation is that whatever initial state you start with, it quickly inflates away and reduces to the vacuum. That's kind of why inflation solves all the problems that it solves. And therefore, if you start with some modified initial state, it's only if you're lucky enough to be looking at, it's only if you can see in the CMB some signature, you know, inflation lasted exactly enough time so that you see what was there at the beginning, and not just a little bit longer, so this initial state inflated away. So is this really an initial state? I mean, it looks like you're putting a condition on the mode at a different time for each
mode. Hang on a minute,
no?
Robert's got his hand up, can I? Robert, does what you want to say have a bearing on this, is going to answer the question, or do you want me to answer the question and listen to your question? Okay, well, why not? I think one way to look at that is the mode actually only lives inside the horizon for a finite amount of time in this picture. And so inflation only has a finite amount of time to erase whatever the difference between this kind of standard initial conditions and the actual initial conditions are. And so once it leaves the horizon, it gets locked in and it doesn't change anymore. And so I think if you're looking at stuff that relates to the kind of zeroth order universe, in other words, you know, homogeneity and isotropy, then inflation can cause the universe to forget about its initial conditions. But what we're really talking about now is kind of a second order correction to the first order perturbations. And so I think the broad brush picture is that you're right that inflation does that. But at least if you put in the initial, you know, if you put in the twist to the initial state in this way, then the universe is going to have some distant memory of what happened during the inflationary epoch.
I think that's only possible if you modify the state at very, very high energy scales.
Yeah, exactly.
In other words, if you rewrote this condition as really an initial state where you imposed a condition on each mode at a fixed time, you'd be imposing a condition all the way up to some very super Planckian scale. And then as those modes evolve and exit the horizon, you still see the effect. But yeah, if you started with a finite energy excitation over the standard vacuum, this wouldn't happen. It would inflate away, and after a few E-foldings,
if you actually look at the solutions to the mode equation, once the modes leave the horizon, once the scale becomes longer than the horizon, they actually cease to evolve. And so whatever twisting they have relative to the standard vacuum when they leave the horizon is locked in, and then that remains locked in when they re-enter the horizon later on.
No, I completely agree, but...
I don't want to interrupt, but some of these will be discussed in the panel discussion this afternoon, so maybe Richard should just carry on for the moment.
I only have a little bit of time. In fact, I'm almost out of time already, so I should press on. But I'm not going to be getting any questions at the end of my talk, I can see that. So I just want to briefly say, so this is the standard spectrum, whatever scale dependence is in the spectrum is in there. So you can see that the amplitude of this modulation goes like H over M. The modulation is actually sinusoidal, so it's something that has, it's not just a bending of the spectrum, and that goes back to Shaman's question, this is actually probably how we'd pull that out of the spectrum, and it's very, very hard to mock this up by messing with the potential. And the last thing we see, there's a random phase, because we don't know the matching between the phase of these oscillations and length scales today. And then the last thing that's in there is a tensor to scalar ratio. And the reason that's in there is that the tensor to scalar ratio essentially measures the rate at which H is changing with time. And so if H is changing quickly with time, then effectively what's happening is that H over M is not constant. And so you're scanning through a bunch of different values of H during the course of, as you produce the modes that actually source the perturbations that we see in the sky. And because we can measure epsilon through the, at least in principle, we can measure that through the tensor modes, it means that if you have this particular form of perturbation where things go like H over M, it means that if you can measure H independently, it means that you have then less freedom in the way that you specify, it means you have less freedom in the way that you specify your model. And so it means that if you actually come to do a fit the data, which is what I'm going to show next, well, here's a modulated spectrum. Let's not worry too much about that. So this is the impact on the CL. And so what you can see is the impact on the CLs for this kind of modulation is messy. And so you can compare that to what you see if you change H. You don't have an explanation for this. It just says, this is looking as H scans from 50 to 100. It means that you can't just look at the CLs and say, that's an underlying oscillation, because the underlying oscillation is completely out of phase with the acoustic peaks. And so what you see will be some complicated convolution of the acoustic peaks plus this modulation that you've put on the spectrum. So what we did to actually see whether we could find this kind of signal in practice is that we mocked up some synthetic CMB data sets, and they're essentially the kind of CMB data set that you'll be getting sort of 20 years from now when there are infinite amounts of money and effort. And so we assumed that they were cosmic variance limited, that they were noise-free, that weak lensing was not going to be a problem. And we went out to L equals 2,000 with both temperature, the different possible correlations that we could imagine having. We assumed that the central values were those given by WMAP1. We allowed all the parameters to float, because if you add new parameters, you've then got to go back and re-estimate all of the other parameters. And one of the things we found is that there are multiple peaks in probability space when you do this. We found out why that is, and we figured out what to do about it. I'm not going to go into details of that. But what we showed is that if R, the scalar tensor ratio, was 0.15, and H over M was 0.004, then we could detect the signal at 2 sigma in the CMB data set. This is all of the things together. On the other hand, if R was very small, then our ability to pull the signal out of the data set got a lot harder. H over M is almost an order of magnitude bigger in terms of what we can see in this what we call the tiny R universe. I'm not going to talk about the islands in parameter space. The last thing I always want to mention briefly before I close is that the way to talk about this kind of effect consistently is to use some sort of effective field theory argument. And so you introduce the transplanck effect by high-dimensional operators. We don't know what the UV completion of GR is. This idea goes back to these people here, who were looking at effects that modified the evolution with an initial thermal state. And this gave what was effectively a P equals 2 effect, that H over M, the effect went like H over M squared. The Columbia group, Conrad Scham, Gary Shu, Jan-Peter van der Schaar, and Brian Green, and I think Jan-Peter and Gary are here at the moment, they actually looked at what happens if you put a boundary into the system that lets you describe the initial, and that then gives you operators arising from the effective field theory approach that also modify the initial conditions, and look like that you may get P equals 1 effects. And I think this is a logical way to tackle this problem. Physically, you can understand what's going on. The approach that I outlined before, they called the new physics hypersurface. They gave it this name. And essentially what you're doing is that the modes are then normalized on this, each mode is normalized as it crosses this line here. So in other words, different modes are normalized at different times. In the effective field theory approach, all the modes are normalized on the same hypersurface. Well, I think this is exactly where I'm getting. The next slide will show the answer to that question. And so the problem is that then there's a clear distinction between the long and short modes, because you've got some modes that were, you know, were always outside the horizon, and everything that happened before that is integrated out into the corrections. And you've got some modes that started well and, you know, well below the Planck scale, and those guys are both going to be having an impact on your spectrum. And so the naive interpretation of this is that the spectrum you get from that is not reliable at short scales. This is the spectrum that you get, and this point here is entirely determined by a free parameter inside of the theory. So it looks like you're seeing some sort of cutoff effect that, at least at the moment, we don't know how to renormalize away. And you also see this linear growth with k. And so the problem is you can put this out of the way. You can move this effect to somewhere where you can't see it by simply changing a free parameter in a theory. But on the other hand, if you do that, then you don't have any impact on the sky. So at the moment, I can't do the same kind of calculation for this approach that I did for our one because of this remaining issue. I know that Massimo Ferrari actually gave a talk at Yale a couple of weeks ago where he took the same approach and felt that he had this. He had the UV modes under control. I don't understand the disagreement between the two groups, because I believe they're starting from the same place. But I think in his model as well, the actual you'd have some, you know, finite region of K where there were fluctuations, and that the location of that region would be in some sense a free parameter. So the question is how to deal with that. So I just want to very briefly run through some tentative conclusions. We haven't done a like, so this applies to the boundary effective field theory case. And I think the one case in which this would make sense is if there was a bounce, and that would give you some special time in the early universe which you could actually associate with some physical event, and you could then see that would be your initial surface. But I think it's harder to understand than conventional inflation. So the conclusions are briefly that we're thinking about very generic effects. We're not trying to tie ourselves to a specific model. It's only a feasibility study, but I think it's telling us that the problem is worth closer inspection, because it does say that in some future CMB data set, there's some corner of parameter space where we may find a detectable signal. So that the problem is definitely worth looking at more closely. I wouldn't spend billions of dollars on this doing these observations on the basis of the calculation that I've presented today, and I'm completely serious about that. But on the other hand, those observations have been done anyway, and those billions of dollars have been spent. And so as theoreticians, we can always think about what kind of value we can add to Planck and ACT and CMB pole and the rest of them. The CMB is limited by cosmic variance. I think one of the interesting things is that large-scale structure is limited largely by our understanding of physics, and that's going to get better, whereas cosmic variance, there's really not much we can do about it. And one of the things I've been hearing from various kind of optimistic observers over the last little while is that the future, sort of 20 years from now, cosmic variance limited large-scale structure survey, or kind of, you know, if we could, you know, deconvolve all of the evolutionary effects, may actually mean that we can legitimately search for P equals 2 effects. The impact of the minimum length is going to be small for any reasonable parameter choice. So that, on the one hand, is telling us that stringy effects are much closer to the surface in cosmology than in particle physics. But they're also telling us, I think, modulo what Robert said before, that the basic predictions from inflation are safe, at least at sort of the 1% level, which is nice to know. The results depend on assumptions about the initial conditions and the overall model. Everyone agrees that H over M is the key quantity, and the argument is going to be over the exponent and over the prefactor. The effective field theory approach is a powerful tool. I mean, it's clearly the right way to do this problem if you have the separation of scales. The ongoing work comparing our spectrum to the lowest order correction from Sham et al. And the comparison with data, I think there's some open questions as to how to actually use the effective field theory approach, but I suspect that will be what gives us the answer to this problem in the long run. And yeah, that's all I want to say, and hopefully I'm not too badly out of time.
Much, Richard. I mean, I'm not sure. Justin said it will be a discussion session afterwards, so I think we need to move on for the next speaker. We're already late. So, Malcolm Fairbairn will be talking about tachyons in cosmology. And
no, go right ahead.